This is a download from the Post-Keynesian Economics Study Group, PKSG. For more information and terms of use, please visit www.postkeynesian.net.
Well, thank you very much. Thank you very much for inviting me. And I think I should, before I begin, just say a few words about myself. I'm not an economist, and that's not an advantage, as some of you may think it is. And I'll come to this point about the end of my talk. As a non-economist, I do lack certain skills in developing my argument. But as what we call international political economists, I hope that there are ways of working together between heterodox economists and people in political science. That's where I'm located. Secondly, I wrote these PowerPoints during this period that many of you probably experienced, and that's a period of examination. And I've noticed I've learned a lot from my students. For example, I've learned to misspell words. I learned some grammatical mistakes and so on and so forth. So please excuse me for that. My general question, if I can define it, kind of a general problematic or an issue that I'm thinking about for the last few years, I'm trying to work out what happens to a system that develops capacities for self-inflating value of assets on a massive scale? Okay, it's a system where assets are denominated upwards, not by 10, 15%, but sometimes 100, 200%. And the process of this self-inflation in the value of asset is largely subjective. It's based on estimation of future earnings, but it's not voluntary, so it works certain rules. And the reason why I think this question is interesting, because that's exactly what happened in the late 19th century, initially in the American economy, but then it was really transferred from the United States worldwide. And that's the question. That's what I'm trying to work out, and I'm looking here at one particular aspect. That particular syndrome or process that I described was described by John R. Commons, one of the forefathers of evolutionary economics, as futurity. It's a term that he coined. My understanding of what he understood by futurity is that he described evolution largely or primarily in the nature of property rights and property rules, initially, again, not in the United States, that took place in the late 19th century. And during that period, we see a kind of transformation, both in the habit of thought and way of thinking about business, but also by the courts that began to understand businesses more as business concern. There's a time element that brought into it. And as business concern, they were valued increasingly against estimates of future profit-making capacity, typically discounted against current rate of interests. Now, Commons made a larger argument or hinted at a bigger argument that I think it's very interesting for both economics, political scientists that I am to think about, that really the effect, the impact of that was that an entire economy, but also politics, began to reorient themselves toward the future. Institutionalists tend to think that we are a product of our past. They tend to emphasize past dependencies. And that's correct, but one of the great innovation of the evolutionary economists is to argue that we are equally product of our future. That in fact the present is almost a kind of tuck and tussle between past and future, rather than think of simply part of the future. That's the way you kind of capture it, which is men live in the future, but acts in the present. Now, in this particular process, and I'll describe a bit this historical process, which actually began in Britain, not in the United States, assets were initially viewed as consisting of two components. One is intangible assets, or in case of businesses, the replacement value of assets, or in some cases, liquidation values. For example, in today's venture capital, venture capitalists are interested in two sets of accounts, not one. One is the intangible value, what will be the future value of this startup, but more interesting at the moment is liquidation value. How much can I get for the tables and chairs and the computers that, you know, how much can I actually, if these things collapse? So there are different ways of estimation. But the traditional way of measuring or accounting for values of companies was, of course, replacement value. And intangible assets became really all the etc. Anything that works above replacement value became intangible. That's why the concept of tangible is problematic, because it's everything else. Also, Commons argued that in time, the implication of this transformation went deeper and more profound in terms of evolution of behavior, and the orientation to a future profit-making capacity rendered component of property, rather than property became for what we traditionally thought in terms of holding something, became the right to withhold. What businesses was about was really about trying to withhold, for example, withholding from markets, sabotage, or one aspect of what Veblen calls sabotage, by which business, for example, kept prices up. Now, the argument I'm trying to run by you, mostly in order to learn from you whether it has any purchase, is the idea that this world of futurity exaggerates pro-cyclical tendencies in the markets for two reasons. First, when assets are largely measured in terms of future profit-making capacity, estimation of future profit-making capacity, the estimation of the future, are much more volatile than the present. And we saw it very clearly, for example, in the current crisis, as wealth disappeared. $50 trillion of wealth have disappeared. And I tend to ask a student, where did it go to? Which big hole did it all disappear to? And of course, what disappeared is the collective, and that's almost a philosophical argument, is what we call, you could call it the market or society's estimation of what the future is. That's what disappeared and reappeared much faster than economy thought. Okay? Because many economies argue that it will take generations to recover that sort of wealth, but no. But volatility also increases because assets in different sectors, for example, shares, real estate, and so forth, are not only valid against the earning capacity in each sector independently, but there's a spillover between them. So as values of shares increase tremendously in one sector, it will have clearly implication on collateral, for example, in real estate, which can be used for credit creation, which can inflate the value of shares and so on and so forth. So it's this relationship between the different sectors that I think create pro-cyclicality. And if I'm correct, the problem is that the regulatory measures that were introduced in the financial system simply don't take it into account. They don't. There's no way of dealing with it. And that could be part of the problem. Now, the history of goodwill, or what became known as intangible, really goes back to much before, much earlier than the late 19th century. And as far as we know, well, I think it began, we see evidence of court cases or the introduction of these particular ideas in British laws in the late 16th century, although on a very small scale. There were a few cases, and then it was accepted that, for example, a pub owner, if somebody gave a bad name or a pub owner, that affects that particular pub owner's business. You say, you know, beer is no good, it's diluted, whatever it may affect the pub owner's businesses. And the courts accepted that if you gave a bad name to a business for no particular reason, then you affected actually that business capacity to make a profit. And hence, that particular person may have a recourse to the court for some monetary value to be paid back. So, in a sense, the court accepted, British court accepted already late 16th century, the idea that a person owns something more than simply physical assets, they own something that we today we will call reputation or goodwill, and it has monetary value. And that particular reputation, goodwill, became, it was not that very significant, it was really at the margin of law, but it became really the basis of libel laws that we see today. Throughout the 16th, 17th, 18th century, there were cases, as I said, but not very significant. The figures that were associated with that, with this particular type of laws and remuneration, but not significant. But the principle, I think, was very significant. The idea that persons can own something which is intangible. But only in the late 19th century, these particular principles become very, very significant, just in just the sheer amount of money that is attached to them. And it became very significant in two set of processes. One I will not discuss, and that's the formation of the railway system in the United States. It was very significant in developing this particular set of rules and laws. But also, but even more significant later on, slightly later, I'm talking about 3 or 4 or 5 years later on, with what we call the first wave of merger and acquisition that took place in the United States, which some dated to the beginning of the 20th century. I think it started in 1881. The practice in the early mergers was to create two set of shares, known as preferential shares and common shares. It was very common at the time. Now, generally speaking, the preferential shares of the company would, broadly speaking, and again, there were never clear laws about it, and accounting practices were a bit divergent from one case to another, but they have tended to represent the replacement value of a company. These were the preferential shares, and normally they would accrue 7% in cumulative interest. So effectively, they were almost like bonds, like bonds. At the same time, companies would also issue common shares, known at the time as entrepreneurial shares, that were not supposed to be capitalized. They were not supposed to sell them to capitalize in the market. And these particular entrepreneurial shares represent the entrepreneurial value or the intangible, the extra that these particular individuals or entrepreneurs added to the market. The promoters of these mergers and acquisitions, the banks, were normally paid in common shares, and immediately they tried to capitalize those common shares. Okay, so this was the practice. It was also known, or economists began to figure out that in fact there were not that many companies traded. For example, in late 19th century, there were only 12 companies traded on the U.S. stock exchange, the Wall Street. Yeah. We're talking about a small comparing to today, right? But so it's a evolutionary process in the sense of just learning about what's happening. But the companies were trading at some excess value above their replacement value. What was going on here? There were few and far between empirical studies both in the US and in the UK about the cause of this excess value, and this research came to the conclusion that this was basically capitalization of future earning capacity. But and they were trying to find some sort of law in this sort of relationship, how much value you had. There was, of course, no law. Okay, but this particular excess value was also described as goodwill as well. Now, let me take you to an example which shows you what figures we are talking about. The first serious merger acquisition was in 1881 of the United Tenors Company, which actually was a failure, but the United Tenors Company was established or capitalized at $131 million in 1881, which, we don't have, of course, good data on GNP at the time, but in retrospective analysis, it's amounted to about 1% of US GNP that year. Okay, if that's correct or not, I'm not sure. Out of that, half of it was common shares. Half of it was intangibles. So 61 million or so, 0.5% of US GDP. And in fact, these common shares were traded, not so much in 1881, but in 1889, for a short period of time, the common shares rose in value from $5 to $40. The preferential shares were initially denominated $6, but then declined. And then in 2 weeks, the owners then sold all the shares. So they managed to capitalize. You're talking about 0.5% of GNP in one imagined position. The most extraordinary case is the formation of the U.S. Steel Trust in 1901, which was established, which capitalized at $1.4 billion, which was equivalent of 6.8 of U.S. GNP, but some people claimed 25% of U.S. GNP that year. I cannot reconcile the two differences, but maybe I'm among economists, they'll be able to help me. The figure is about half of that figure were common shares. Okay? So even if you take the lowest figure of U.S. Steel of 6.8%, capitalization of U.S. Steel at 6.8 of U.S. GNP that year, about 3.something% of GNP was simply created on the spot at the moment just as intangible value. Okay? Let's leave Carnegie alone here. It's a very interesting story about the role of Carnegie and what he managed to do. So we're talking about a huge amount of money. I did some studies of it. I tried to calculate the figure, but my sense is that between 1880 to 1910, every single year, between 2 to 4% of U.S. GNP, if you accept the figure of GNP retrospectively, was created just as intangible. Created as intangible, simply intangible value. Simply companies that were valued X number amount, now were valued twice the amount on a massive scale. And that's what I'm trying to figure out. What does it mean? And there are various implications of what could it mean. And one of them, I think, it generates this pro-cyclical. Now, the figures for the UK were nothing like the US, but they were quite serious. There's evidence that in the UK, already there were quite serious cases of merger acquisition and a huge amount of intangible value was created, much less so, if any, in Germany and France. I cannot find good information about Germany and France. Maybe somebody else has. I discussed with some accountant, but it seems that the practice was seriously frowned upon in Germany and France at the time. So actually it was Anglo-Saxon developed, specifically Anglo-Saxon phenomena at that time, and more specifically United States, US. Okay? If I were an economist. What does it mean when we have this huge generation of intangible value, basically, effectively, and it was capitalized, okay? Effectively, we have a huge increase in the value of companies, the shares, which would then use, companies or entrepreneurs will use them to capitalize or to as collateral in order to borrow in the markets. That's, we see a huge increase, of course, in credit market around that time, which they invest some of it in the real estate markets in the United States. Again, we see huge inflation and so on and so forth. And to my mind, this becomes now a self-fulfilling or a self-circulating. To the point that, in fact, we today have no idea about what is true value of assets. In terms of bubble, we simply work on historical precedents of what is the markup that we accept. So this is the process that I see as leading to enormous degree of pro-cyclicality, which can go both ways, both in terms of optimistic estimation of future of the future or pessimistic. So that's kind of built into the system. If I were an economist, I guess I would be able to demonstrate empirically that this is what took place. Okay, but I'm not. So my argument here is purely theoretical and speculative. But it might be, or at least I put for you the proposition, that what appeared to us as a credit crisis, or even a Ponzi crisis, might have been at the heart an exaggerated form of this pro-cyclical crisis, or at least this is another dimension to understand how could we have inflated value to such an extent and then disappeared. Thank you very much.